Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dory Smith.
I see Wall Street as a crime scene. You know, that one of those crime scene programs ought to get down there right away, okay?
Media Channel and Global Vision, Inc. founder and executive director Danny Schechter joins us to talk about his new book, Plunder, Investigating Our Economic Calamity and the Subcrime Scandal. First, we've been covering the painful case of Troy Anthony Davis, who was about to be executed on Tuesday, September 23rd, when the U.S. Supreme Court stepped in to say it would review his appeal earlier than the September 29th date originally planned. Troy Davis has been on death row for 17 years for a murder he maintains he did not commit. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution of Georgia has been covering the case. Editorial page editor Cynthia Tucker came out in support of a new trial for Davis. She notes in her September 24th op-ed that if Davis had occupied a higher rung on the social ladder, he probably would not have been convicted of murder in the August 1989 shooting of a Savannah police officer named Mark Allen McPhail. At the time of the shooting, she writes, Troy Davis was working for meager wages and looking for a better job. She also points out Davis's father worked in law enforcement, but by young adulthood, he had acquired a petty rap sheet. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution has been covering the drama that has unfolded as one witness after another stepped forward to recant testimony before Georgia's Board of Pardons and Parole. The board nevertheless denied Davis clemency. Another man, Sylvester Coles, also African-American, went to the police station shortly after the police officer was killed and pointed the finger at Troy Davis. Coles admitted being on the scene, and a witness named Larry Young has identified him as the man who hit him that night at the murder scene. Young identifies Sylvester Coles as the real killer. Other witnesses whose testimony once got Troy Davis convicted have now testified Sylvester Coles was the killer. The case now pending at the Supreme Court for consideration probably Monday will likely hinge on interpretations of the laws on presenting new evidence, specifically new evidence from witnesses who recant earlier testimony. Mike Stark is on the board of the National Coalition to End the Death Penalty and an anti-death penalty activist. He spoke with us just minutes after hearing that the U.S. Supreme Court had issued a stay of execution to consider the Troy Davis case.
I'm delighted. I'm overjoyed. Not only has the state of Georgia been prevented from executing an innocent man, but I think more importantly that the death machine has blinked here. The pressure and the effort of tens of thousands of activists across the country and around the world has really had a demonstrable result. The Supreme Court routinely will conference at a last minute and turn down requests for stays and deny cert petitions. And in this case, the fact that they instead granted a stay of execution in order to have an orderly and proper hearing of the arguments that Troy has made, I think is rightly counted as a victory. You know, Martina and Thomas and everybody down in Atlanta are right to be screaming out for this victory. We're clearly not out of the woods. We need to keep up our pressure and keep up the efforts. But I think this is a tremendous victory and should be celebrated.
Mike Stark is on the board of the National Coalition to End the Death Penalty. Joining us next to offer his view on the Wall Street bailout is Danny Schechter. He predicted the financial meltdown with a 2007 film, In Debt We Trust. Danny Schechter is author of numerous books, including Embedded, Weapons of Mass Deception. He was in management and broadcasting for WBCN-FM, WGBH, CNN, and ABC. And has won Emmys, an Iris Award, a George Polk Award, a Major Armstrong Award, and honors from the National Association of Black Journalists. Here's a bit of the trailer for the film, In Debt We Trust.
We're all living beyond our means. We're all living on credit. We're all living with debt, and it's growing every single day. The national savings rate is now zero. Americans spend more than we earn.
So this is Shirley, and I'm calling from Card Service. We're in the office today to 10 p.m. Central Time, and it's urgent you return the call today.
Stop sending me credit card letters, man. I don't want any more credit cards. I already have bad credit.
This message is from Joel Sussman. I'm calling from FBA in regards to your gold option program.
It's not about race anymore. It's more of a class separation in this country. and the very, very wealthy continue to thrive and survive. The rest of us are just trying to scratch and make.
What's driving a lot of the debt among these households is not a lack of budgeting or a lack of financial savvy. It's an economy that is increasingly stacked against them.
They're making 54% net profit. That is evil. And they're making it off the poorest members of our society. That is evil.
The U.S. government is in the red. Big time.
Danny Schechter, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you.
Well, as someone who's been writing about this for some time now, should we be calling this a depression?
You know, I don't think it's quite a depression yet. It's certainly depressing. And it depends on who you are and where you live. If you're poor, if you're minorities, if you're living in areas with very high unemployment rates, then this is a depression. It's been a depression. If you're on Wall Street and you just lost your job, I would say it's more of a recession. But the whole situation is so volatile right now. No one knows what the outcome will be.
And you're saying there's a lot of emphasis now on the power of Paulson. Just talk about your latest blog and what you've been writing.
Well, Paulson, you know, is the Treasury Secretary, and he and Bernanke went to meet the leaders of Congress.
Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke.
On Thursday last, and basically told them that unless we act right now, we're going to have the biggest meltdown of our whole financial system ever. It may be irreversible. Basically, they scared the Congress with, you know, this forecast, which, of course, up until then, they had been sort of gussying up, talking about the soundness of the economy and all the rest of it. Now they were finally coming clean and saying, you know, we have a crisis here, a serious problem, and we have to act. And then they proposed acting in a 3-page memo, which in essence gives total power to Paulson and asks the $700 billion for a bailout with no particular accountability to Congress or anyone. So in a sense, you know, it's Hail Caesar time as Paulson becomes, you know, the man, the power. And the question is, who's going to benefit from this so-called bailout? And can this even work, which isn't even clear? Because what they're proposing doing is buying up what they call toxic waste, you know, illiquid assets, and put it under the government and then resell it somehow. But they don't know, first of all, what they're buying, because they don't know what assets there are out there, really. That's one of the big problems. And they don't know how to price it for resale anyway, or who would buy it. So we have a situation here where it seems like the beneficiary are going to be the owners of these bonds and securities, who are Wall Street people. And, you know, the Democrats jumped in there and said, hey, wait a minute, if you're going to do a bailout, what about putting something in there for distressed home owners? You know, the people who are suffering the most, who are losing their homes. And Paulson said, no, no way. He says, I want to keep this clean. You know, I don't, in other words, he was trying to hold off any ads or any conditions from Congress. But it gives you a sense of their attitude. Their attitude is my way or the highway. And moreover, they're acting in a sort of panicky environment here. You know, he says, we have to do this. The alternative is too horrendous to even think about, et cetera, and so forth. So in a sense, you know, I see a parallel with the war in Iraq, you know, where if we don't act immediately, there's going to be bombs dropping in our cities, you know, nuclear weapons, WMDs. So I want the authority to do this. And many of the members of the Senate, you know, overnight basically gave the administration, based on, quote, intelligence, which turned out to be not so intelligent, authorization to go to war, which they, of course, have used for the last, how many, 7 years. So, you know, of course, I'm suspicious of all this. It is interesting that both Obama and McCain are supporting this bailout, but I think the Democrats have a lot more questions than the Republicans do.
Well, there's discussion of another stimulus package. What about the question of research into the number of poor, working class, middle class Americans being affected by all of this?
You know, I don't think it's time for another study. We actually know an awful lot about what people's needs are. We see unemployment climbing, creeping up. I was on a program with Nouriel Roubini, who's the leading economist on this whole issue. He expects unemployment to go to 8%. We know that 3.5 million families are facing foreclosure. The Congress just this past week actually did not support an additional stimulus package aimed at working people. They rejected it, apparently on the grounds that they had added some things in there that the Republicans weren't happy with. But I don't think there's a lack of knowledge of needs. It's a question of who has power and what their priorities are. And what we're seeing here is, you know, a situation which is totally tilted towards the people who already have, not the people who need.
Danny Schechter, what about the new book on this issue?
You know, I've just written a book called Plunder, Investigating Our Economic Calamity, where I document this, how this actually happened, and who's responsible. And, you know, there seem to be three forces that are responsible for this. First, you know, the Wall Street firms, their greed, their avarice, their cleverness in creating so-called exotic financial securities and all kinds of ways to take mortgages, make securities out of them, repackage them, sell them overseas to banks and other investors, and misrepresent their value, misrepresent the value of mortgages that were being sold to poor people. So there's the firms, they're a part of the piece. Then there's the regulators who weren't there, weren't paying attention, weren't enforcing the law. And in many cases, these Wall Street people created what they call a shadow banking system outside the purview of regulation. They did it, you know, quote, legally, but clearly it's unconscionable in terms of its effects. So the regulators have to be held account. And then there's our media, which never covered this story, you know, from 2002 to 2007 when the market melted down last August. There was almost no coverage of subprime lending, predatory lending, the concerns of community people about what was happening to their neighborhoods, the tremendous profits the Wall Street firms were making, you know, $31 billion, $32 billion in bonuses every year. I mean, they were just kind of cleaning up without any scrutiny. And at the same time, something like $3 billion in advertising was being injected into media organizations. So they were carrying ads for these dicey lenders. They were carrying ads for the credit card companies, getting people deeper and deeper in debt. So, you know, media didn't just play a, you know, hands-off role. They played a really negative role. And, of course, they didn't do their job in terms of alerting us to what was coming. So all of a sudden, out of nowhere, it seems, this whole crisis erupts. And I have to say that people on the left, and that includes Pacifica, many were not paying attention to this either. You know, we were concerned about, you know, the election, about Sarah Palin, about, you know, Bill O'Reilly, about, you know, all the issues that have obsessed progressives and not paying attention to the economic crisis that was building and simmering and was already resulting in a million foreclosures.
How far back does your book look at this problem? Where do you see it sort of originating?
Well, you know, I have some historical perspective. I'm not an academic and I'm not an economist, hence I think I'm readable, you know. But, you know, what I try to do is go back into where did these subprime loans come from? You know, originally this was a reform and a way to try to get minorities home ownership and to make it easier for them because they couldn't afford the prime rate mortgages. And so this was initially kind of a reform in part because there had been this anti-redlining laws passed in the aftermath of the Reagan administration, and the banks in various poor neighborhoods basically just decided to close their doors and not even cooperate with it. It basically was saying you can't discriminate in lending. So along came subprime lending as a way, you know, look, you pay a little more, but you know, if you're an upstanding citizen, et cetera, et cetera. But then they just completely obliterated all the conditions for even subprime loans, and they started giving out what they called a ninja loan. Have you ever heard of that?
The ninja loan, no, but I'm not surprised you kept track of that one.
Ninja means no income, no jobs, no assets, no problem, basically, okay? In other words, people were given loans who didn't have any money on the grounds. They were being told, look, your value of your real estate is going to go up. The value of your home will enable you to take out equity loans and the like. So, you know, you can't lose. And a lot of people bought into that logic until suddenly they found themselves living in places that were unaffordable. And this is the case of many people who just can't afford their mortgages when these adjustable rates kick in. And the people making the loans knew on the basis of what these people had in terms of their income and their taxes, et cetera. They knew that they couldn't afford it, but they went ahead anyway because they were making so much money reselling these mortgages by slicing and dicing them into what are called bundles or packages and reselling it. So they were making money. The richest institutions were making money off the poorest people. And we've had this sort of strip mining of a lot of poor neighborhoods, black neighborhoods particularly, but Latino neighborhoods as well, throughout America. And nobody was talking about it because this myth of home ownership was so implanted in so many's mind. You know, you want a beautiful home, you see it on TV, you want it too, you know, and many people couldn't afford it, and they're living in cars now, or they're living in tent cities. I mean, this is a real social crisis. Nobody's talking about that. They're talking about the crisis on Wall Street as if it's just a crisis for bankers.
Now, you have been writing about what you're calling the Troubled Assets Relief Program, or TARP. Is that an official name?
Yeah, that's what they call it, yeah.
Okay, so a lot of people living under a TARP, but they don't matter in this particular plan.
Right, exactly.
Okay. And this now is Troubled Assets in Plunder. And I've heard about this book, by the way. Are you looking at possible crime and, you know, issues of...
Well, I see Wall Street as a crime scene. You know, that one of those crime scene programs ought to get down there right away, okay? Because laws were violated, regulations and rules were violated. This was a group of people who were extremely, you know, the masters of the universe, arrogant, clever, and manipulative, and were able to maneuver outside of regulations. I mean, a lot of what they did was a game called Beat the Regulator. And the regulators weren't watching anyway because the Bush administration philosophy is no regulation. Okay. So here you had a situation where the regulators were, you know, kind of making noises but not doing anything. And these guys were able to get away with this on a massive scale. In the neighborhoods, these predatory lenders were misrepresenting their products to people. People didn't know what they were signing in many instances, or their greed was being encouraged by these brokers who, of course, immediately resold the mortgages. So they weren't really holding it. Now, something like 290 various mortgage companies have imploded or gone out of business. And so it's going to be hard to track them down. Now, the FBI has opened up a criminal investigation. And in their statements, they say this is a massive problem. They have 1,200 or 1,400 investigations underway. They've indicted 400 people so far. Now, most of the time, of course, the Bush administration, FBI, would go after the small fry, not the big fish, you know. But they have indicted a couple of Bear Stearns people. And the question is, you know, will they have the budget to do more, you know, with all the pressures on terrorism investigations, et cetera, and so forth? Will they be able to pursue this? Apparently, there were a lot more FBI agents working. Now there's a few hundred. There were a few thousand working after the SNL debacle. So this is a big white-collar crime wave that we're dealing with, and people don't see it as such. Most of the press doesn't write about it as such. Also, it's an international issue. We've sold these bogus mortgages overseas to banks all over the world who've now had to write down their own portfolios because they're holding, quote, asset-backed securities or mortgage securities that have no assets behind them. So it's like a Ponzi scheme, you know. They thought they were buying X, but they ended up buying Y. And part of the reason is that the rating agencies like Moody's and others certified these mortgages AAA, you know, the top rating. Then it later turned out that the people who were asking them to do the rating were paying them on the side or directly. There's a complete conflict of interest. But again, this issue is not something that people have zeroed in on. Paulson was saying, you know, this is because there was irresponsibility on the part of the lenders and the borrowers. He equates both of them. So Mrs. Jones in Detroit, who's just lost her home, is equal to, you know, some major bank, which is ridiculous. But the papers are publishing this without pointing this out. And this crisis, there's still a lot more questionable debt out there. There are these credit swaps, there's Alt-A mortgages, there's all kinds of other instruments that are of questionable value. And it's unclear that they're going to be able to really solve it with this approach. Now, it's interesting. A year ago, actually in December 7th, 2007, Jesse Jackson had an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal calling for a resolution trust corporation like the one Paulson is now proposing. So that was 10 months and $2 trillion in losses ago. But he, of course, was ignored. So these people only act when their system or their interests are at stake. And this is one of the big issues here.
Speaking of international implications, who's going to bail out Washington? Is it going to be China again? I mean, they're talking about trillions.
Chinese Investment Corporation is already looking at, I think, taking a piece of Morgan Stanley. We've been dependent on Asia and investors in Asia to keep our balance of payments and whatnot. You know, basically they've been financing our deficit. Now they're turning away from investing in America. You know, there have been articles in the New York Times quoting people in Asia saying, I don't trust any American bank, any institution. China has called for a new economic order that's non-American in control, which means this is the end of this whole empire. You know, also the last two investment banks, independent banks, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, now say they want to be bank holding companies, not investment banks, which means that they will come under more regulation and they'll be able to have deposits. So this whole Wall Street map is being reshaped before our eyes. Now, most people not following this don't really get what this is totally about. Obviously, the bottom line is always the bottom line. It's money. But, you know, that's what I try to go into in Plunder. The book is a follow-through on a film I made called In Debt We Trust. And that film warned of this crisis. It came out early in 2007. And at the time, it was greeted by some reviewers as being alarmist. You know, how can you have so much gloom and doom when the economy is doing so well? And I'm pointing out, look at the size of the national debt, you know, approaching $11 trillion, $3 trillion in consumer debt. Everybody I know having problems with credit card debt and the like. And yet this issue wasn't on the agenda of either political party at their conventions. It wasn't in the platforms. And both candidates have only reacted once it became news and they were asked about it. And both Obama and McCain are supporting the Paulson bailout. We tend to define rights sort of in political terms, you know, right to free expression, freedom of speech issues and the like. And we don't look at economic rights issues, social and economic rights. It's almost as if that's not on our agenda, a bill of economic rights. You know, what FDR talked about back in the days of the Depression when he criticized what he called the banksters of that era. You know, the idea of freedom from want, the four freedoms, you know. The left seems to have dropped all that. Labor unions became obsessed with one word, which was more, higher wages, benefits, and the like. And they weren't really fighting for economic justice for all Americans. And I think many progressives have been very reactive on political issues, you know, in cases of injustice, which certainly deserve our solidarity and concern. I'm not disputing that. But there's something really missing here, which is, you know, when the livelihoods of Americans were at the level they're at today, and I see no response. People who are concerned about slavery and slave auctions, they're not concerned about house auctions in our cities where people are losing their homes that they struggled for. There's nobody out there disrupting these things or trying to challenge it. In other words, the whole issue has not been sort of politicized. It's sort of, we would rather focus on an individual, you know, that we, you know about Mumia, for example, or which we should be concerned about. I'm not disputing that. But larger issues of trying to identify with and support and be in solidarity with working people who are losing their jobs, losing their hope, you know, is something we need to get involved with. I was down in Washington in July with an organization called NACA, the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America. They were at the Capitol Hilton Hotel in D.C., three blocks from the White House. And lo and behold, they were basically offering free counseling to people who had mortgage problems, okay? 20,000 people turned up, standing in line from 4 in the morning to 11 at night. 20,000 people. These were, I would say, 80% not white, but whites were there too, who were suffering, afraid of losing their homes, and they were coming to try to get help in getting their mortgages restructured so that they could become more affordable, modifying the terms of the mortgage. And this showed me the extent, the incredible extent of this crisis. And yet when I looked around, the AFL-CIO is one block away from this hotel. There was nobody there from the AFL-CIO. There was nobody there from the progressive think tanks in D.C. Now, Pacific Radio, to its credit, Verna in Washington and others did get on it and did provide time for people to come on the air and talk about the issues, whereas NPR really didn't. They just went and got some sound bites. They really didn't explain what this was all about. You know, it's much easier to treat people as victims, okay, than as people who are actors in their own, you know, drama trying to fight for change. And it was ironic to me because the Capitol, this hotel had been headquarters of the March on Washington in 1963 that I was part of. Okay. There's all this historical symbolism. It was also across the street, literally, from the Washington Post, which during the event that was taking place didn't send a reporter across the street. After the last day, they did do some very supportive articles, but not while it was happening, so more people would have known about it. So we have a media failure here also, so it's not just a progressive failure, but it cuts across the board. And I think that this is an issue. If you care about change in America, if you care about, you know, what will the Obama administration, if there ever is one, be able to do when all of their options have been preempted by the Bush administration, in essence, by the spending of more than $1 trillion, for starters, that this bailout is going to cost. How much money is he going to have to really work with to do any of the things he wants to do? That's why the political debate to me seems to me to be very unreal, because nobody's paying attention to what's actually happening at the heart of our economy in the housing market.
What about, finally, the question of the escalation we're seeing in the war on terror as it's being conducted in Afghanistan, across the border into Pakistan? Now America says they're going to be giving nuclear technology to India. Are we going to see a bunch of changes in the way the U.S. starts to fund countries and the IMF starts to fund countries?
Well, we've always known that one way the United States government gets money is selling weapons, okay? And this is part, that's one of our prime businesses, basically, weapons and airplanes. So this is continuing, and this whole drama is continuing. And, of course, the war has cost, what, $1 or $2-3 trillion and growing every single day. So that's another economic drain. But I don't know if you noticed this, but Army Times, this paper of the U.S. Army, it's independent but reports on the Army, reported that a whole unit in Iraq is being redeployed to the United States to be available for civil disturbances. In other words, if this crisis hits bottom, as it could, there's going to be a lot of economic pain and a lot of anger, probably a rise in crime, probably some resistance to people getting cut off welfare or other programs. And what are these people going to do? And so the Army is being trained to come here, and supposedly for humanitarian purposes, but civil unrest is one of their themes. And I believe that the events that we saw at the, in St. Paul outside the convention were rehearsals by the police, basically, not just for what was happening there and the, quote, anarchists, etc., but to have tactics that they can deploy when there is this civil unrest, which they are afraid of. So don't think that there won't be a reaction to all this. You know, the law of karma is, you know, what comes around goes around. It's happening to the banks. They were so smart, they were so wealthy, and now they're on their knees. And I think we're going to have a reaction from the American people to this. And that's why I believe it's important for all of us to inform ourselves. I feel, you know, humbly that my book, Plunder, my film, In Debt We Trust, can help. But I'm certainly not the only one writing about this. We need a new teach-in movement to start educating everyone about this economic crisis, because many people have not been following it. So thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it very much.
Danny Schechter, News Dissector, it's really a pleasure to have you on. Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
Danny Schechter, his new book, Plunder, Investigating Our Economic Calamity and the Subprime Scandal. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in the studios of WHUS at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. WHUS.org to listen live, Wednesdays at 5 p.m. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions.